For many people, 2012 will begin with popping a bottle of champagne or sparkling wine. It's the go-to drink for the celebratory moments in our lives. And it turns out, champagne is far more versatile than you may think. Beyond just pouring it into a glass, you can mix it with any number of spirits to create a range of champagne cocktails. And for a few ideas, we're joined by respected mixologist Greg Sider. He co-owns the Summit Bar in New York's East Village. New York Magazine once named it the city's best cocktail bar, and Greg Sider is at our New York Bureau. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Jack. Very great to be here.
Happy New Year to you.
Happy New Year to you.
You know, the champagne cocktail is one of my favorite celebratory drinks. How do you make yours?
We have a bunch of different versions. One that starts off like a little simpler, French 75, would be a simple gin, lemon juice, slight bit of agave, topped with Prosecco or champagne would be like a nice starter.
And what's the classic champagne cocktail? I just thought champagne, a little bitters, a sugar cube.
That would be your original.
Let's get to your New Year's Eve recommendations. You gave us one that you call a GP Spritz. Tell us about it.
Yeah, the GP Spritz actually inspired from my friend Andy Mosier down in Atlanta. So what I do is I take hibiscus flowers and I infuse that in agave. And we add Aperol, a little bit of lemon juice, and then actually a hibiscus tincture, which is basically a concentrated bitter. And shake that up and then actually serve that on the rocks. And we top that with 3.5 ounces of Prosecco.
Well, I'm reeling already. Where do you get hibiscus flowers in the middle of the winter, though, if you don't live in Atlanta?
You can just get the tea. And you would just do a concentrated, maybe you do 8 tea bags to, if you didn't have agave, you could do half sugar, half water. And you do like 8 bags of tea to a quart, and then you have a nice syrup that you can use as a go-to.
Okay. So keep some of that hibiscus infusion on hand.
Yeah, it's like an emergency, along with batteries and the flashlights.
So you also mentioned using Aperol in this spritz, and that's an orange liqueur.
Yeah, the reason Aperol I find more versatile is because it has a rhubarb orange base to it, but it doesn't quite have the bitter finish of a Campari.
Mm-hmm.
So I find it's more accessible for a lot of people.
Give us a warm drink, would you please?
Well, I like to do like kind of a twist on the hot toddy. It's always like nice and simple where you could use Irish whiskey. I like bourbon or rum as a nice twist, and just add some honey, a little bit of ginger, a squeeze of lemon, and hot water.
I love the way you just play with flavor.
Yeah, it's from like my culinary. I do a lot of cooking, and my friends are some of the best chefs in the city. So I get all my ideas from cooking, actually. I don't really get much inspiration from actual bar.
Greg Sider owns the Summit Bar and Prima in New York City, and he spoke to us from our New York Bureau. What a way to start the year. Thanks.
Cheers.
Go to our website, npr.org, for the recipe for GP Spritz. This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. Scott Simon comes back next week. A happy new year. I'm Jackie Leiden.
The food trends of 2011 included high-end food trucks and gourmet versions of everything from hot dogs to Twinkies. So what lies ahead for 2012? Weekend Edition food commentator Bonnie Wolf has a few ideas.
There's a new vocabulary: authentic, craft, small batch, artisanal, rustic, and of course, local. It's the opposite of processed, mass-produced, and factory-farmed. What might be called urban neo-ruralism has apartment dwellers canning tomatoes, keeping bees, churning butter. The small farmer is the new gastronomic superhero, sourced on restaurant menus. Independent butcher shops are opening across the country with unfamiliar cuts like Denver steak, petite tender, flat iron. Expect more specialty meats, too. bison, elk, goat, rabbit. Whole pigs and whole fish are prepared in restaurants, and there's more interest in nose-to-tail dining, where no piece of the animal goes to waste. Think internal organs. And bone marrow. It's being smoked, tossed with pasta, served with tamarind sauce. Bars, too, are speaking the language of authenticity. Local craft distilleries are making small batches of bourbon, rye, vodka, gin, and bitters. There are absinthe and mezcal bars. Modern moonshine is also on the ascendancy. If it's made legally, it's called white dog or white whiskey. Like the hooch made in unlicensed stills, it's raw, unaged corn whiskey. Can you get more authentic? Look forward to even more attention to detail in food and drink. There are micro roasters of organic coffee where each cup is individually brewed. There's even craft ice. One New York bar freezes 300-pound blocks of ice, free of impurities and bubbles, and it's someone's job to harvest the ice. The international flavor of the moment is Nordic. A few years ago, a group of Scandinavian chefs signed a culinary manifesto promoting purity, simplicity, freshness, and ethics. The most famous practitioner is René Redzepi, who runs Noma in Copenhagen, just named the best restaurant in the world. His staff forages in the woods, and the menu includes such things as sorrel granita, musk ox, pork skin and chicken skin, accents of hay, pine, moss, and juniper. For dessert, Jerusalem artichoke ice cream. Savory ice creams should be popular this year, too. When New York Magazine asked Redzepi what he thought of the so-called new Nordic cuisine, he said he thought it should be called regional, authentic cuisine. Like I said.
Bonnie Wolf is working on a book about the foods of Maryland's Eastern Shore. This is NPR News.
When America built up its modern economy in the late 1800s, one effect swiftly became apparent. Clothing makers had to manufacture larger suits as Americans gained weight.
Today, something similar is happening in China. For 30 years, people have been eating more as their incomes grow. Fast food chains, supermarkets, and street food vendors are flourishing, and obesity is on the rise. NPR's Eliza Barkley reports on what the Chinese are doing about it.
Two young men hunch over a bucket of fried chicken. They're inside a sparkling new KFC in Shanghai. I ask them through an interpreter if they're here often.
It just become a habit because they're very early. They just get used to the taste.
Fast food has become a habit for a lot of Chinese. KFC first opened its doors in Beijing back in 1987. It now operates more than 3,000 stores in China. McDonald's has about half that many, and there are dozens of Chinese chains too. It's no surprise that people are getting fat. But fast food is only part of the problem. Paul French is a market analyst in Shanghai. He's written a book called Fat China. He says people are just eating more.
More of everything. Larger portions with more ingredients, more salt, more sugar, more oil, more fats. Breakfast and lunch and dinner and supper and grazing with snacks during the day and drinking fizzy drinks rather than tea.
A lot of the people, they have the obesity, overweight. So I think it's a serious problem.
That's Cy McKean, a nutritionist at Shanghai Zhou Tong University. She says all this overeating is partly a reaction to the food shortages under Chairman Mao a generation ago.
At that time, Chinese people not have much food to eat, so they're very slim. But right now, we have much, much more food, so they eat more, so overweight.
But many people, especially in the middle class, are discovering that you don't have to eat and eat just because there's plenty of food available. Take, for instance, the Liu family. I visited their apartment in Shanghai one evening while they were cooking dinner. Mr. and Mrs. Liu share three modest rooms in a concrete high-rise with their 25-year-old daughter Jun Ting and a spoiled cat. Mr. Liu moved to Shanghai from a remote town in the north before Jun Ting was born. He says that the food rations of his youth shaped the way he ate decades later.
Before, our living standard was not good. So when there was a chance to eat meat, we usually ate a lot.
When his income rose in the 1990s, he could, for the first time, eat as much meat as he wanted. And for a while he did. But now he has realized it's not so healthful.
Nowadays, because we are living a better life, usually we don't eat much meat. I pay special attention to this issue, so you can see, I am very slim.
Today, the Lus had what they call a heavy lunch with meat. So for dinner, Mrs. Lu is preparing congee, the traditional boiled rice soup. She says that by keeping some of the old ways of eating, their diet stays balanced and they don't eat too much. Junting Lu, the daughter, is a translator for a Dutch newspaper. She's slender with long, dark hair. She grew up eating mostly fast food. But now, like many people of her generation, she's eager to learn more about the food of the past.
More and more people, I think they're now realized that maybe going back to the traditional way of eating is better.
But Paul French points out that just going back to this traditional way of eating isn't the answer. He says what people really need is to learn how to make good choices.
The most popular Chinese breakfast is youtiao, which is a double deep fried dough stick. I mean, that is extremely unhealthy.
There is plenty of nutritious food available, and Anna Hu is working to help people discover it. She has created a website with lots of information about healthful eating. Today, she has brought me to the Ao Hua Farmers Market. There is an astounding variety of vegetables here. Far more than previous generations of Chinese ever had. Until recently, Anna worked crazy long hours selling software.
5 to 6 years, I eat every day outside. I never eat homemade food. And then because, you know, outside food is oily and salty, and you cannot choose so many vegetables.
She says that she was eating all this junk, she felt like the city was swallowing her. So she read modern books about nutrition and forced herself to try strange new vegetables. Now she cooks them at home. She also features recipes on her website with ingredients like the broccoli here at the market.
This local broccoli is so small. I think it's more nutritious. It's better than the larger one.
In many ways, figuring out how to stay slim and healthy in modern China is a bit like the struggle Chinese face in other parts of life. It's how to decide what to keep from the past and what to take from all the new choices a growing economy offers. Eliza Barclay, NPR News.
The meaning of all kinds of cultural traditions can get lost in translation. Reporter Ari Daniel Shapiro unearthed the story behind one in this report on holiday foods in the Haitian community.
9 years ago, on New Year's Day, David Gunther was faced with a mini-epidemic. He's a family doctor, and at his old job in Somerville, just north of Boston, many of his patients were from Haiti.
10 or 12 patients all complained of pretty similar symptoms, belly pains. They weren't terribly ill, but it was clear that there was some kind of a pattern.
Gunther almost alerted the Department of Public Health to this mild GI outbreak. But then one of those patients with the stomach trouble figured out what was going on.
And she explained that most likely they were all suffering from the same problem, stomach upset related to eating too much of a holiday soup.
So nothing infectious, just a squash soup overdose.
Yeah, we eat a lot of it.
That's Marie Romulus.
I'm from Haiti.
In her cozy kitchen in Somerville, she pulls out a hefty stainless steel pot. In 2 days, it'll be brimming with her squash soup.
Or in Creole, they call it soup jomo.
During France's rule of Haiti, this soup was off limits to the slaves.
Because we were in slavery, so the commander never let the slave have the soup. The soup was considered superior. The slaves were considered as a little lower class. So when we get our independence, we were free to have a soup.
Haiti gained its independence on January 1st, 1804, so Haitians eat soup jomu every New Year's Day. It's orange, and it's a mix of squash, potatoes, and meat. Romulus likes to add some spaghetti to hers.
It's really energetic, like it's a combination of everything. If you taste it, you will like it also.
Romulus eats the soup 4 times on New Year's Day, and that's not as often as some. She thinks that overeating may have caused the GI outbreak at the clinic 9 years ago.
You have to space yourself, not to eat everything at once, you know?
So when you eat it, what does it make you think about?
Whenever I eat it, I always think about my great-grandfather. They used to be in slavery, So I feel like I am free. And when you have the soup, you really feel full.
Full of freedom. For NPR News, I'm Ari Daniel Shapiro.
This is NPR News.